Accession number 30407, Mr. Ralph Curtin, Reel 2. We're talking about your life in Birmingham, you know, leading up to when you called up, really. But, I mean, what about the cinema? Was that an important part of the social scene at the time? Because it was for a lot of people. How about for you?
Yes, it did. My brother and I used to go and watch on a Saturday morning the local cinema. It used to be a film, a cowboy film, plus Flash Gordon. And Flash Gordon was a spaceman, and he used to have a rocket always used to go off and go somewhere, and something would happen, and it would always finish where he was in trouble, and you'd have to go the next Saturday to find out whether he got out of it or not.
So the cliffhanger business.
The cliffhanger bit, you know, they come back again, real, as it were. Yeah, that was interesting. Yes, the cinema did help a lot. We used to see a lot of newsreels of the war that we were shown through Pathé News.
Did you follow the progress of the war? I mean, right from the start, when you were just a young lad, you know.
Well, Father, he actually, I always remember it, he had a map, and he used to alter the map on reports that we got from the wireless and newspapers. He would trace it, move the line, whatever. So, yes, that was interesting.
Even during the bad bits?
Even during the bad bits, yes. Yeah, very much so.
I'm thinking the first couple of, well, 1940 was...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you knew where the lines were, and you followed it.
We followed it.
Did you have any relatives in the war? Your father was in the Home Guard, but I mean...
No. No.
So there wasn't that personal tinge? You weren't watching any particular unit or anything?
No.
Now, what about pubs? Did you? I know you shouldn't have done, and you were from a religious family. Did you drink at all, or did your friends drink? Did you go to pubs?
Oh, yes. We eventually got to the stage where both my brother and I had motorbikes.
Well, tell me about, I mean, that that was a hobby on its own, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
They're quite expensive, though. Then.
They were. Well, it was expensive in the sense that I got to know of an HRD 500, which had its engine seized, and the owner wanted to sell it, and I bought it for £5 as junk, and that virtually emptied my bank account, and I stripped it, and I took it down into that cellar we used to go down in at Coplow Street, and worked on it. By then I'd put a light in from one of the junk rooms upstairs. I'd put a light in down. So we had a strip of fluorescent strip down there and put a light in, and then a little workbench so that I could work down there. And I rebuilt it, and I had a serviceable bike. So that was me. And then Dennis bought another bike, a small one, a 250 Velocet. And then eventually we worked him up to a Sunbeam shaft-driven bike. And then, of course, by then we'd formed our own friendships with our own age groups. And we used to go somewhere on the bike Saturday, Sunday. We'd find a pub and have a few drinks. Come back. It was a Saturday night. We'd go dancing. So, yeah, we enjoyed it. We were able to get out and get a bit of air from the city, as it were.
Now, you weren't in anything before. You weren't in any training organisation or anything before you were called up. Then, so
only the scouts.
So, anything else before you get called up? Because I think you get called up what 44, wouldn't it?
Mm.
Because I know you've got a story about the Navy, the business about...
Oh, yes. Well, I joined the Sea Scouts.
Ah, now tell me about that.
Well, it was a unit in the centre of Birmingham, and
it seems a strange thing to have in central Birmingham, the Seascout.
But there you are. I suppose most big cities have got Seascouts or something somewhere. And I used to attend that, and I used to enjoy that.
Tell me, what training did they give you at the Sea Scouts?
Signalling.
How far did they go into it?
I used to do the semaphore with the flags. And then, of course, things like knots.
Did they teach, did they teach you Morse as well, you know?
No, I didn't do the Morse one.
So it's just...
I only did with the flags, yeah. General knowledge about sea training, sails,
seamanship,
port and starboard, and so on and so forth. Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed it and was looking forward to going into the Navy.
Now, there's a sort of prompt, I'm not sure whether promise is the right word, but tell me what they told you.
Well, I spoke to the lieutenant. The naval lieutenant, and he told him that I was probably going to be called up very shortly, and I was worried that I wouldn't get into the Navy, and he said, well, don't worry about it, and he took all my particulars and sent them off to somewhere and said, don't worry about it, you'll be called up in the Navy. But as it turned out, it didn't work out.
Now tell me about your call up. What was the whole process of being called up? It's quite a big thing, isn't it? You know.
I received papers, and the papers said that I was to join the army, the Air Force, and report to Cardington.
So there was no tests or medical before you went to Cardington.
No, that all happened when I arrived there.
So you were just, and that was what, late May 44, would it be?
That's right.
Now, what did you think? How did you react when you were called up to the RAF? I mean, a lot of people tried to get in the RAF, but, you know, you'd wanted to be in the Navy.
Well, I thought one of the things I could do was, if having got into the RAF, was try and get into the Naval Air Section, if I could. But obviously, having been in there only a couple of months or so, it didn't work out.
Now, tell me what happened when you got to Cardington. You, what was it at Cardington? What was that?
That was a training base. It was a, you know, the induction assessment.
Was it aircrew reception or?
Yeah, aircrew reception. I was training. I'd been selected to go in for. Flight engineer training,
which is aircrew.
Aircrew, yeah.
And what did you think about that? You just thought you wanted to get in the RNAS doing the same thing?
Yeah.
If you could. So what happened when you first got to Cardiff? That would be late May still, I presume, 54. Well, what did how were you received when you arrived there? You know, because you're a civilian, aren't you, when you
arrived? Oh, yes. Well, we arrived. We were allocated to a hut under a flight sergeant.
What was it sort of like? I mean, was there a lot of shouting, or was it friendly reception, or what was it like?
General shouting. The usual thing.
Unfriendly or just sort of...
Unfriendly and yet friendly. More of a father figure come director than anything else, to sort of get you into some sort of order, to get things moving along, get you in the right frame of mind, point out what you should and shouldn't do. Drilling obviously took
now,
place.
Hang on. So how long were you at Cardington? Were you there right until you left the RAF? Because you leave in August, so yeah. It's only 3 months, isn't it? It's only 2 months, yeah. So you were at Cardington for that whole time?
For the whole time, yes.
Now, what was your hut like? What was your accommodation like?
It was quite good. I mean, from experience of other things and other times, I would say it was quite good.
So can you describe, because that's one reason we're doing it, is to compare Air Force. Yeah. What was your hut like? What pattern was it? Or how was the beds laid out?
Long with beds and compartments and a cabinet at the side of the bed, for a locker to put your uniforms and bits and pieces in. Bathroom was down the bottom, toilet facility, so on and so forth. Yes, it was quite, it was in England, it was, the barracks were quite good.
Now what about kitting out? What did the RAF give you?
Oh, well, you get your forage cap, you've got a uniform, you've got underwear, socks, boots, a great coat, belt, gaiters, washing kit, all the usual accoutrements associated with anything in the game of the Army, Navy or the Air Force.
Now we look at a sort of typical day's training, how it started, you know, with the RAF, I mean. I know you weren't with them for long, but 2 months, because it's mainly as a contrast. What was a typical day's training like with them? How would it start?
Well, it would start at about 5:30, 5:45 in the morning. You'd be woken up, get yourself into the showers, shave, wash, get dressed. Then you would take your eating utensils and mug with you and get down to the assembly hall where the food was.
Now, what did you think of the food in the RAF?
It was good.
In what way? I mean, was it better than you'd had at home, or? Well, you know what I mean.
It was adequate. It was adequate.
Was there enough of it? Enough of it?
Well, you didn't like going back for second because it wasn't a done thing, but it was enough to get you by. And of course, you could always go to the NAFI if you were. Able, if you went in funds, you could always go to the NAFI and get something extra if you wanted it.
So after breakfast?
Then you would be assembled into your flights and the training would take place. You were marched off. Basically, the first 2 weeks, a fortnight, we did nothing but training, marching, counter marching.
Now, how did you take to drill? You'd never really done it before.
I'd never really done it before.
A bit with a Boy Scout, but...
Yeah, but... obviously, they wanted to instill into you an ability to work with other people, to move a large body of men in the shortest time, in the shortest distance.
That's part of the training. How did you take to it? I mean, some people can't do it.
I took to it like a duck to water.
You enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it.
What did you enjoy about it? Because a lot of people enjoy drill, funnily enough, but they do. What did you like about it?
It was the knowing that physically I could do it. That it was there was no great strain in being able to do it. And the pleasure that we all got, I think, from eventually... being able to pass out on the passing out parade, as it were. That was what it was building up to, and comradeship, and so on and so forth.
Now, for the first 2 weeks, so you wouldn't do much else at drill?
You wouldn't do much else at that, no.
What about spit and polish? I presume you did that in the first 2 weeks.
Oh, yes, very much so.
We're quite interested in spit and polish, especially compare with the Army. So what level of bull, as they could call it sometimes, did they expect of you in, say, preparing for a room or a kit inspection?
Very high. Very high. They would turn out everything. Everything. Window ledges, inside and outside, toilets. Scrupulously clean everything. Everything rigid, everything in place. It was to instill into you discipline. The idea behind all of that was discipline, purely discipline.
What about your kit? So how would you get your uniform in the state they wanted to, you know, from boots? I mean, boots can provide their own problem.
Well, the corporals were assigned, a sergeant and two corporals were assigned to each billet. The corporals lived in the billet, the sergeants didn't. And the corporals used to impose an hour's boot polishing every evening and equipment cleaning, especially when we were issued with rifles. Then, of course, it got even more so. You just had to get on with it.
Was there any special method you used to get the boots ready? Were they like the army ones, splat with the yeah. pimples?
Yeah, you had to work on those. They used to come and give you a hand, like the corporals. If you were a good squad, then the corporals would help you, and sometimes the sergeants would, not always, but sometimes.
Did they show you the tips? You know how to do how to oh, get yeah. rid of the pimples, oh, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Use a bone, you know, to flatten it down and get some sort of shape into it. And of course the boot polish used to be, what was it now? Was it Johnson's black boot polish? Something like that. But black boot polish anyway.
And was it really spit and polish?
Yeah, oh yes. Work at it. Keep going.
And were you any good at it? I mean, you know, because some people are really good at it and some people aren't quite, even though they try.
Yes, well, it took time. It took time. And I didn't have that much time, really, to get them in the shape that I was advised to get them into.
How would you lay your kit out? I mean, did you have to lay it like in the army,
yeah,
lay it out on
your
bed?
Exactly the same. Exactly the same. No problem. I found that very useful when you went into the...
What were the kit inspections like when they came round? I mean, would they, you know, there's always this thing where they sometimes tip them up. And
tip them up. If the sergeant would come round, if he wasn't happy, the flight sergeant, if he wasn't happy, he'd tip your bed up. And that was it. And start all over again.
Would the officers do that in the proper inspection?
No.
So the officers would just tell you...
No, no.
It was just right.
No.
Now, any other training you did? I mean, you said you got rifles. Did you actually start on rifle drill, as in learning to shoot?
We had firing practice in the bots.
So they'd have to teach you from scratch. I mean, you didn't anything about rifle, I presume, about rifle training. Mm. So how did you do that? How did they go about it?
You had a flight sergeant armourer who took us. And we also put us into, and a similar thing happened later on, took us into a room where there was a turret, you know, a pivoting turret with air rifles in it. And you had to load the air rifles, you had targets, and you put silhouettes up and you had to fire at them, see if you were any good at it.
That's a sort of turret simulator for in case you wanted to be an air gunner.
That's right, yeah.
And how good a shot were you at either of those things?
Very good.
Why do you think you were good? Was it because of the training or good eyesight?
Good eyesight.
Is that the most important thing, do you think?
No, I think reaction and good eyesight are the basis. Reaction times.
Now, what do you mean by reaction times?
Well, some people are quick and others are slow. If you see something moving... I've always been able to pick it up, like when I played cricket. I kept for my local team.
Kept wicket?
Yep. I kept wicket. Oof, bang.
Broken nose.
Broken nose, yeah. And I was always good, always have been.
So you were able to pick up the flight of something very quickly?
Very quickly, yes.
Any other weapons training?
Not there, no.
Oh, yeah, no. So, now, any other training you did with the RAF? I mean, I'm very conscious it's only 8 weeks and you spend a lot of it on drill, so there's not a lot of time for anything else. Anything else they did do?
Well,
though?
Flight recognition of
aircraft.
Aircraft.
Now, how did they do that? I mean,
well, they did it with slides, and what they did, they took us into a darkened theatre and they shut us down and. They put all the lights out. And after 5 minutes of complete darkness and quietness, that somebody came up, like a lieutenant or somebody would say, now there is a visual situation somewhere around in front of you, and as soon as you see anything at all, speak up. And you would see, say, a man with a gun, or a building would suddenly materialize as your eyes adjusted. It gradually filled out into a complete scenario of aircraft swooping in and all sorts of things. And then the aircraft were German, and you had to identify what aircraft they were.
So that's not only aircraft recognition, it's night vision training.
Night vision training as well, yes.
And how did you do at that? Was your
eyesight
good?
I did very well at that, yes. Yeah.
Any other training? So, how were you getting on with the other lads? You know, I mean, the other recruits? I mean, because that's always important in training.
Well, obviously, we made friends with chaps either side of us and in the actual flight room. But as I say, we apart from the basic training and going to the NAFI or going to the wherever for a lecture, we were lectured on hygiene, lecture on personal stuff, lots of lectures.
Well, tell us about that. We'll come back to what were the lectures on then? There's hygiene.
Hygiene, yes. Venereal disease, so on and so forth.
Was that the frightening one with the film?
Yeah.
Did it frighten you?
Yeah.
What other lectures?
Aircraft recognition.
That's all right.
Not now, much more than that, really.
So tell us about these lads you were getting on with. I mean, what were they from the same sort of background as yourself? I mean,
no, they came from all over the country. A cosmopolitan collection of IRCs, as we were called. Pongos.
Aircraft from the same class.
AC-2s.
I mean, was there any bullying? I mean, because sometimes there can be bullies in groups. What were they, a friendly group, or was it
friendly
any
group? Yeah.
No bullies.
Well, I didn't encounter him as such. No.
And you felt reasonably all right with him? That it made.
I mean, some people had stronger views than others, but it didn't mean to say that they imposed them on us and we had to follow their dictates.
So it's just a normal group?
Just a normal group.
Now, what about the instructors? What do you think of them?
They were good. They were good.
Now, what made them good? Do you see what I mean?
I think they were long-serving personnel. They'd seen it, done it, been there, had, and everything that goes with that. They were good, solid personnel. They had to be.
And they were sympathetic to the...
Yeah, they had a lot of people passing through, and I mean, they were building up rapidly, and therefore they had only a certain amount of time in which to, as it were, whip you into the situation and condition that they wanted you. So they pushed you as hard as they could.
Now, it didn't last long, did it? So
it did
can you
not,
explain
no.
what happened?
Well, one morning we were told to report to the flight office, which we duly did, and on the board it said, all those from number so-and-so and so-and-so to so-and-so number will report to the flight office with all their kit, which included me. Consequence of which we were then put into RAF trucks and taken to the local station. And there was something like 200 or 300 of us were put on this train late in the afternoon. And it trundled off into the unknown and travelled through the night. And in the early hours of the morning, we pulled into a station. We didn't know where. And we were put into army trucks and taken considerable distance. And as we viewed it from the inside, looking out at the rear of the truck, we realised we were in some sort of estate, building estate, which was surrounded by double-strength barbed wire and sentries at the gate. Next morning when we woke up, we were informed quite rudely and abruptly that we were in the army. Now, this didn't go down very well.
Now, which camp, where had you been sent to?
It turned out that it was Heighton Transit Camp, Heighton, Liverpool.
Is that spelled H-U-Y?
H-U-Y, yeah. And as I said, it didn't go down very well, and there were four houses in a block in which all the RAF personnel on the training course that I was on, the flight engineers course, were in this block of four, and it was unanimously decided that we didn't want to be in the army, and they wanted us to sign some papers to say that we were, and we refused. So this led to retaliation on their behalf, which resulted in us being denied privileges like going to the NAFI and so on and so on, petty little things. But we still held out, and obviously they had to feed us, so we used to go and get food and escort us back again.
So you refused to sign. Did you have to sign something? Or
yes, we had to sign transfer papers. Consequently, in the finish, they sent for our flight captain, the gentleman that was in charge of us in the RAF. He arrived one day, about a week later, and they took us into the communal hall, and he spoke to us at length and said, "Now, come on, chaps, this isn't the way to do it, esprit de corps and all that." And we said, "Well, you know, we were flight training for flight engineers. We don't want to be sprugs in so on and so forth. It's just wasting our experiences." So eventually he came to an agreement with the military authorities there that all those who were mechanically minded, which we were, we had a choice. We could go into the REME, R-E-M-E, or the Tank Corps. And quite a few of us decided that we'd go into the Tank Corps.
Now, why?
Well, we thought if we were going into the war anyway, which we were, may as well go mobile. If we're going to ride into battle, we may as well go in behind some armour rather than foot schluckers.
It was as simple as that.
Simple as that. That was a simple equation of that. So it was agreed that those who wanted to would go into the Royal Armoured Corps, or the Armoured Division of the Army, and the others would go into REME or whatever, field artillery, whichever they wanted to do. And that's the way it broke up. So we all signed eventually. They were happy, we were happy.
And this was late August 1944. Well, not that late, around about 12th of August. So.